The news has come fast and furious from the Black Sea lately. The Ukrainian revolution was hitting its peak at just about the time the Winter Olympics were wrapping up to the east in Sochi, Russia. Sochi was also the scene of protests against the regime of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The protesters included members of the punk group Pussy Riot, and it is on that group that we'll spend our focus this hour. Our vehicle is the brand new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha Gessen wrote it. She's a journalist with Russian roots living in the United States now. Her work is published far and wide in many well-known publications. She's also written several books, including a recent bestseller on the rise of Vladimir Putin. She's also edited several publications and served as the director of Radio Liberty's Russia service. Masha Gessen, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Given the earlier book and the circumstances in this one, I'm surprised that we didn't actually get to the name of Vladimir Putin until page two. It seems like he would have been right there in the first paragraph or so.
Well, that would be giving him a little bit too much credit.
Which is not the point here. When did you first become aware of the whole Pussy Riot phenomenon?
You know, I wondered about that. Actually, that was part of the impetus for writing the book, because when I heard about the action in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, which is the action that got them arrested, and I remember that moment very, very well, because this was when my girlfriend was in labor with our son, and I read the news that they had staged this protest. I thought, oh, what a good thing, and what a precise target for a protest. So I already knew who Pussy Riot were, and part of my investigation, actually, in writing the book was to find out who they were and how they came to be Pussy Riot, but also try to figure out how they sort of managed to put themselves on the radar in a very, very short time.
Which they really did, you focus primarily on three major women: Nadezhda Tolokonikova, Maria Alyokhina, sorry if I'm slaughtering the names, and Yekaterina Samutsevich. You start with Nadia. How did you get to know her?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
How did you get to know Nadia?
How did I get to know Nadia? I didn't really know her until she went to jail. So most of the reporting for the book, most of the reporting on Nadia was actually done through correspondence with Nadia in prison. It was complicated. It had a lot of conditions placed on it. Some of them were necessary for Nadia's safety and security. So one of the conditions was that I couldn't ask her about the action. I couldn't ask her anything that had to do with the actual criminal case. And that's a pretty expansive category. I also couldn't make the letters look like I was interviewing her. They had to seem like a casual exchange. I therefore had to use a pseudonym, which I actually found very difficult, because it's hard to write as someone other than you, you know, especially if you're writing personal letters. And the way it worked was that I could email her through a special prison email system, and I could pay for her to respond to me. The payment was per page. It was about $1.70 per page. So in essence, I was giving her writing assignments. I would write a bunch of questions and then, you know, put a value on it, like 3 pages or 5 pages. And she would get a printout of my letter and as many blank pages as I had paid for. And then she would write longhand. And the prison authorities would then scan the letter and email it back to me. It would always go through the censor. So there were certain things, there were funny things, like there was an incident in high school that involved Nadia supposedly taking a jar of glue without permission. And we had to actually carefully tow around this this incident, because it could be construed as theft that she had committed.
Which might have added to her sentence, for example?
Which might have at least added to, not to her sentence, but to the recommendation that the prison authorities would have written whenever her case came up for parole.
So it sounds like the toughest editing job of your entire journalism career is trying to make sure that you could get things cleanly into her, and then she apparently had to do some editing work herself, particularly when she had more to say than what you'd paid for her to write back.
Well, actually, what I was worried about was paying for too many pages and putting her in an uncomfortable situation. I mean, I was actually really concerned about the power dynamics in that correspondence. And ultimately, I think it worked out all right. It wasn't the toughest job of my writing career. I mean, before that, I had reported a book on Vladimir Putin, who was not a cooperative subject. And before that, I'd written a biography of Grigory Perelman, the Russian mathematician who proved the Poincaré conjecture and went into hiding. So, you know, in fact, the members of Pussy Riot were the most accessible subjects I've had in years.
So it sounds like for Nadia, there's a genetic strain of activist. Tell us about her her father.
Her father is an odd bird. He identifies as an artist. He lives in the woods, as he says. Well, actually, he literally lives in the woods in a hut in the woods outside of Moscow. He was a very strong influence on her as she was growing up. Her mother was kind of strict and by the book, and she lived with her mother most of the time. Her parents divorced when she was four. And then her father would take her for the summer or for a few weeks in the summer. Now, her mother lived in Norilsk. Norilsk is one of the most miserable places on earth. It is the largest city that far north. It's over 100,000 population. It is dark most of the year. It's Arctic night, polar night, and when it gets light, you realize just how dreary it is. It's terribly polluted by the heavy metal industry that's there.
You describe the snow as being metal. Black from the factories.
Absolutely, and the air feels like it's kind of, you know, it has palpable metal particles in it. Everything about it is sort of black and white and mostly black. And then her father would take her out into a colorful reality of Moscow or the Russian South, and he himself was very colorful.
All right, let's talk more about Nadia's father when we come back from the break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. Masha Gessen is our guest. Her book is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Back with Masha and your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen. Her latest book out in early January is called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, an examination of the people who formed Pussy Riot and what they're all about. And it's a very interesting book that gives you a lot of insight into their backgrounds. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Pussy Riot and its ongoing campaign against the regime of Russian President Vladimir Putin and what else they stand for. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been talking about Nadia, Nadezhda Tolokonikova, and her father, who came from this horrible black and white city, which, as you describe, is one of the worst places on earth. But he found a way to introduce some color into her life, you were saying.
Yes, he was, I think he annoyed her mother and every other woman in his life to no end. He is one of those men who do things their way. He's never really held down a job properly, but he can talk to children, and I've been witness to that. I've spent time with him and his granddaughter, Nadia's daughter. He can talk to children. He can get them involved in discussing art and music, and that was something that was also eye-opening for Nadia. She credits her father with introducing her to literature that she wouldn't have known about, to art that she wouldn't have known about, and to turning her into the critical thinker, the very critical thinker that she is.
Well, I never stopped to think about it in this context before, but these women are young enough that they were very young when the Soviet Union split apart, so they really have no particular memories of the really gray days of the USSR, do they?
Well, they were born around the time that that the Soviet Union was falling apart, too, but Nadia and Maria. Katya, you could see it in some say, she's a little bit older, but she really wouldn't have any living memory of the USSR either.
So in the example of, say, Nadia's parents, what happened to them and their just their general fate when the USSR split up and the new Russia was having its birthing pains?
I think they belong to a generation that's severely traumatized by the breakup of the USSR. They had a certain idea of their lives. And then the distinguishing characteristic of Soviet society was that it was static. Nothing changed. You could see your life sort of for decades ahead. You knew it wouldn't get any better, but you also knew it wouldn't get any worse. Eventually, you'd have your own apartment if you worked hard enough, and maybe someday you'd have a car. And then all of a sudden, life seemed to offer endless possibilities. You could get rich, or you could slip into poverty. But it also seemed to get very dangerous. And I think that that Nadia's parents' reactions to it were actually fairly typical of their generation. Nadia's mother became extremely sort of goal-directed and buttoned up. And Nadia's father just went all out for the possibilities it offered, you know, like the possibility of not holding down a job.
Which, how has that affected him financially? I don't know what kind of a safety net there is in modern-day Russia. I mean, has he been able to eke out an existence without working much?
I'd say I had to buy every meal that had to do with our spending time together. I think he leads a very precarious sort of material existence, but that he seems comfortable with that.
So you mentioned that he introduced Nadia to a lot of ideas. A lot of poets introduced her to the idea of critical thinking, very critical thinking, as you pointed out. But she really kind of took her own education in hand, didn't she?
Absolutely. She is an autodidact. She created her own curriculum besides school. She had a reading list of Russian philosophers. And then I think there's an amazing incident when she was around 16, a Moscow conceptualist poet named Dmitry Prigov read in town. She went to hear him. She realized there was a whole other area of art and thinking that she wasn't aware of. So she put that on her reading list. And that actually played a very important role in the aesthetic of Pussy Riot and the aesthetic of an earlier art group called Vaina, which Nadia was also part of. And actually in her romance with her husband, Petya, who's been a very important character in this whole story.
Where did Petya and Nadia meet?
They met at the philosophy department of Moscow University, where Nadia was a very young student, and he was a wiser and older and cooler man of 20. And he had lived abroad. He had heard Judith Butler speak, which fascinated Nadia. And he was also very taken with her because she was 17. She was incredibly beautiful. If you've seen pictures of Nadia, it's striking that kind of physical perfection can exist anywhere. And then when she opened her mouth, she talked about the Russian philosophers and the Moscow conceptualists. And, of course, they were both smitten.
This whole, the Moscow conceptualists and Prigov, the one name you mentioned separately, what was it that they were about? I mean, what were the concepts that they were espousing?
They are a little difficult, I think, for an American audience to understand. But they, unlike the dissident artists and writers of the 60s and 70s, the Moscow conceptualists who worked in the 80s, sort of instead of resisting Soviet language and Soviet reality, they made art with it. They tried to bend official language to suit their artistic purposes. They played with the monotonous landscapes of Soviet block construction. They made beauty where beauty couldn't be seen with the naked eye. And I think that use of official language for their own purposes is actually something that's been very important to Nadia and very important to the conceptualizing of Pussy Riot, because part of what they tried, part of the problem they tried to solve was how do you create protest art in a language in which where language has been discredited, where for 70 years every word was used to mean its opposite. And then for a short time there was glasnost and perestroika, and words seemed to take on meaning, and then that was discredited. So it's sort of a doubly corrupted language, and there were no words left to express truth.
So they'd kind of taken a situation that already had been turned 180 twice and turned it another 180 by the sounds of it.
That's what they tried to do, and that's why they settled on punk. As Nadia said in her closing statement in court in August 2012 in Moscow, we looked for a place of maximum sincerity, and that's what we found in punk. And that does go very deeply into the origins of punk.
So it's an interesting concept to try to understand, as you've already pointed out, difficult for American audiences or non-Russian audiences to understand, but they were looking for a way to express themselves that would be really genuine in a society that up to that point had not been really genuine for a very, very long time.
That's a very good way of putting it. They were trying to get through to a public that had become completely inured to language, to messaging, to any expression of political passions, and I'd say expression of passion, period.
It looks like her first taste of protest, and again, we're talking about Nadezhda Tolokonikova. Her first taste of protest was something called the March of the Disagreeable, is that right?
Yes, this was a protest movement that existed in Russia in the early 2000s. Garry Kasparov, the chess champion, was one of the people instrumental in it. And it was a first sort of taste of hope and a first taste of protest in Putin's Russia. I remember thinking that that maybe it would lead to something. Actually, when I looked at my notes back from the Marches of the Disagreeable and back from time that I spent with Kasparov in those days, it seemed like maybe they would be able to create a mass movement. That mass movement didn't come to materialize until much later, until 2011. The police were very effective at quashing it, sort of at first attempt. But I think that taste of marches, of confrontation with the police, of talking with other young people who were looking for ways to express protest, that was very important for 17 and 18-year-old Nadia.
We are talking to Masha Gessen about her book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. It's something of a biography, or at least a background examination of how Pussy Riot came to be. And, of course, this is the same group of people that is still in the news just within the last couple of days. More beatings, more arrests as they appeared at the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what Pussy Riot is all about. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to step back just a bit and give a little greater context here, Masha, because I think it's still really hard for Americans to understand what happened. There was all that hope upon the breakup of the Soviet Union and all the new possibilities that existed with the new Russia. And you do get in the section about Nadia about that context and point out that Vladimir Putin, when he first rose to power, really had the economic reformers on his side at about the time that Nadia went to college. But what did he do to them? How did they end up out of his camp? And what did he actually do to them?
Well, Vladimir Putin is a former KGB agent. In that line of work, there's no such thing as former. When he came to power in Russia, he immediately initiated two processes. One was dismantling the Russian electoral system, and the other one was taking over the Russian media. Some people realized it right away. Some people were a little slow to figure out what was happening. But what was happening was that he was creating an authoritarian form of government and doing it actually very effectively. So naturally, in the process of doing that, he gradually alienated all the economic reformers. He gradually alienated any thinking person in Russia, any liberal person in Russia. But it actually took years. And the reason it took years to alienate all of those people was because Russia, simultaneously with Putin's coming to power, entered a period of unprecedented prosperity, simply because of rising oil prices. He has been incredibly lucky to be able to ride that wave of wealth at the same time as he was creating his authoritarian regime, which I think is why it has taken so long for protests to foment and why it has been so ineffective so far.
Is there still a sense that you gather from in modern-day Russia that people can get as rich as the people they hear about? I mean, and some of the situations you describe are truly amazing. You know, these luxury shops springing up, the Bentley dealership selling out its latest allotment of cars before they're even delivered in cash. So, I mean, some truly fabulously wealthy people. Is there a sense of upward mobility in the average Russian heart, though?
Not at all. The sense in Russia, and this has been the case for a long time, is that they're the very rich, and most of the country is struggling to survive. Now Russia is in the midst of a major economic slowdown, and that means that the inequality is getting only greater. And part of what Pussy Riot brought to the table, which is not written about very much, is really for the first time a leftist critique of what has gone on in Russia in the last dozen years. And their early protests were actually focused on the unbridled consumerism of the Putin era.
Is part of the strength then of Pussy Riot and its predecessor organization, you mentioned Voyna, I want to talk about them in a little bit, but is part of the strength of what they do the fact that it's almost like a really pure drug that people aren't used to experiencing? It just really goes right to the brain?
That's a great way of putting it. And Voyna and Pussy Riot, they share some of their aesthetic. They're actually very, very different in approaches. Voyna was sort of always over the top, always so rich in symbolism and its actions that it would take forever to unpack any of them. In fact, there's a famous action of Voyna, partly made famous by the Putin administration, which was using it to discredit Nadia, which was an action where they went to the zoology museum in Moscow and staged a group sex scene there, where several couples that belonged to Vina were naked and having sex in the museum, and they called it, using profanity, they called it the Have Sex for the Air Teddy Bear, which was a reference to Dmitry Medvedev, who had just been anointed Putin's heir to the throne, and whose last name means bear, but he also actually looks like a teddy bear. Why were they having sex for the heir teddy bear? Well, as I found out when I finally interviewed Katie about it, they meant to communicate the message that Russian public politics was to politics what pornography is to sex, which actually is a great way of putting it. But that's not a message that you would have gotten from watching the action. The action was spectacular, but extremely confusing.
Right, but ultimately what they've done is they've converted their actual lives into art, it sounds like, or at least in trying to deliver a message. Let's put it that way.
Well, actually, in Pussy Riot's case, they have a very clear line of separation between their art and their lives. And that line is actually very symbolic. They say, you put on a balaclava, the face mask that they've become famous for, you're Pussy Riot. You take it off, you're not Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot participants are, by definition, anonymous. So you don't know who is singing and who is performing. That was actually part of the difficulty of reporting the book, was because there were many people I interviewed who had at some point or another taken part in a Pussy Riot action. But I wasn't interviewing them as Pussy Riot if I knew what their names were. But I could only interview them as Pussy Riot when they were wearing the balaclavas. And at first that was a little confusing to me, because they would talk about Pussy Riot in the third person as though they weren't Pussy Riot. So there's this line that Pussy Riot has been careful about. But you're right. I mean, this is actually very much in the Moscow conceptualist tradition, is make art of your very being. That's what Trigov used to say.
And some of the other members that we haven't even talked about yet, Kat or Yekaterina Samutsevich, you had the best access with her because she was not actually in prison, which is something I don't think the world really understands. Why did Nadia and Maria go to prison when Yekaterina did not?
Well, the world is not the only one who doesn't understand it. I think it's confusing for a lot of people, including Kat herself. Basically, what happened was there were three women were unmasked and arrested and put on trial. The trial, I think, can only be described as a witch trial. And the longest chapter in the book is on the trial. I think that there's very little of me in it and a lot of the transcript, and I think it speaks for itself. They were all sentenced to 2 years in penal colonies, and then they were sent back to their holding facilities pending appeal. All of them had someone in their cell trying to pressure them into somehow giving up. This is standard practice for political prisoners, for the handling of political prisoners in Russia. They always have someone in their cell, or several people in their cell, who are trying to inform of them, who are trying to influence them, who are trying to somehow interfere. I think Kat, for a number of reasons, including severe emotional trauma that she suffered during the trial when she found out that her father had testified, I think she was the most susceptible. And basically, all the state was trying to do was split the group up in some way. So she became convinced that she couldn't handle the prison transport, that she couldn't handle the penal colony. She became desperate to try to figure out how to get out of this predicament. And somehow she stumbled on a solution, I think it was suggested to her by her cellmate, of firing the defense lawyers and getting a new lawyer. She fired the defense lawyers. She got a new lawyer. The new lawyer, who was very, very good and a human rights lawyer with a great track record, told me she didn't realize it was a setup until she was in the appeal hearing. And when she realized, when she started hearing sort of positive reinforcement from the prosecution, she realized that it had been a setup, and she was only there to help Kat sort of break ranks. It was too late to do anything about it. And Kat was released, which is nothing to sniff at. I mean, she avoided a year of torture and slave labor, and nobody should begrudge that. But as a result, she sort of ended up at loose ends. There she was, kind of free, but on parole, which means she couldn't protest, she couldn't speak out as Pussy Riot, or she felt she couldn't. She felt she had to act, but she didn't know how to act and not land back in prison.
Much more to talk about with Masha Guess in her book on Pussy Riot is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, which we get to know some of the key members of Pussy Riot a bit better than we perhaps do now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Back with Masha Gessen and your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is Pussy Riot. It seems unfair to call them just a punk band because they are actually a whole lot more than that. But they are the focus of Masha Gessen's book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha Gessen, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join our discussion as we talk about modern-day Russia and the ongoing protests against the regime of Vladimir Putin. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's come back to that point. I mean, the very tactics of Pussy Riot came out of, you mentioned some previous conceptual art sorts of situations, and they had chosen punk as a way to be the most sincere. So what's the general MO? I mean, when Pussy Riot was really cranking things out, what was it doing?
I think it was trying to identify issues in Russian society that Russians weren't used to looking at, even the Russians who were involved in the protest culture. And that's what made them true sort of cutting-edge protesters, and that's, of course, what ultimately got them arrested. So the action for which they got arrested was what they called a punk prayer in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. The Cathedral of Christ the Savior is the biggest, most official, most gilded cathedral in Moscow. This is where the presidents and the prime ministers like to go on church holidays and stand in front of the cameras holding their candles. And this was where Pussy Riot went to protest the symbiosis of church and state, and the fact that the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church was campaigning for Vladimir Putin, who was running to be elected to his third term as president. And the patriarch was basically comparing Putin to God, and also telling people not to protest, telling Russian Orthodox believers not to take part in the anti-Putin protests. So they went to the church, they put on their balaclavas, they took their guitars, they went up on a platform that, called the Solyas, which is in front of the altar, and they attempted to sing their punk prayer, which went, "Mother of God, chase Putin out." The protests didn't last more than 40 seconds. They were removed by security and then released. But then they were rearrested by police 2 weeks later, three of them, on the day that Putin actually declared his reelection to a third term in office. And they were prosecuted. And what I think is important to remember, and is almost impossible to believe now, is that 2 years ago this happened, and they were the first Russians who were actually given real jail time for peaceful protest. Now it's become almost routine. We're seeing dozens of other people who have been in jail for years and will be in jail for years as a result of peaceful protest.
So through the vehicle of Pussy Riot, the Russian regime pretty much took the veil back and said, so what? We're gonna stop being nice about this now. We're just gonna start putting people in prison for speaking out against us.
This was the beginning of the crackdown. I mean, this was Putin's reaction to the protest movement, which I think terrified him. It communicated to him for the first time that his regime was not necessarily eternal. And he responded in the most constructive, actually, way for a dictator to respond if the dictator wants to stay in power, which is to quash protest.
When you look particularly at the cover of the book, which shows, about eight people standing up doing a Pussy Riot protest, were there other people who were central to this? I mean, you focus the book on three, Nadezhda Tolokonikova, Maria Alyokhina, and Yekaterina Samutsevich. But were there others who were really central to Pussy Riot?
Well, that's a very difficult question, as I said.
Oh, because, when the balaclavas are on, they're Pussy Riot, yeah.
say anonymous. There is at least one person in the book who is actually quoted extensively, who was central to conceptualizing a lot of what Pussy Riot was. I would still say that Nadia was definitely the mastermind behind Pussy Riot. She is the feminist scholar. She is the one who made up. Pussy Riot originally was a fictional character. Nadia was asked to prepare a presentation on feminist art for an opposition conference. And she made this presentation, and she realized she kind of needed to finish it for the Russian group, because otherwise it looked kind of bad to just show a lot of things that existed in the West and didn't exist in Russia. So she made up a fictional band and fictional art group and called it Pisha Riot. And she and Kat recorded a song that they attributed to Pisha Riot, which is in the book, and which sounds very much like a caricature of what a Riot Girl type group would write if it existed in Russia. But then they liked the idea so much, they made Pussy Riot real.
There is there's an interesting backstory for Pisha Riot. What does the word Pisha actually mean?
It's a childish word for genitals. It's like wee wee. So I translate it as wee wee riot.
Wow. I mean, but it's amazing. I mean, we giggle, I suppose, that, you know, the words like that. But the fact is that these people had a really serious message to bring forth, and in doing so have paid some really serious consequences. Did they ever see themselves in these roles? And in fact, when you go back to Maria, for example, she said she couldn't even tell you when she became an activist.
Although she did. She said she couldn't tell me. And then she proceeded to tell me exactly how she became an activist. I just quote that whole part of her letter to me. But yes and no. I mean, I think that they are remarkable for taking themselves very seriously. This is unusual for young people. It's unusual for people in Russia. It's unusual for protesters in Russia. I think part of the sort of corrupting influence of living in an authoritarian state is that gradual loss of agency, that inability to actually take yourself seriously and take your views seriously and take your actions seriously. And they did all that. At the same time, they certainly didn't expect to go to jail for 2 years. It was a prank. I mean, it was a brilliant prank. It was a spectacular prank. It was a prank that a bunch of college students staged. At that point, the most they thought they had to fear was 15 days administrative arrest.
Which I guess then raises the question about, and again, there are some things that do not cross cultural and language boundaries. I mean, what they do could be considered something like satire, I suppose, in the United States, but there's a harder edge to it as well. I mean, this is a punk protest sort of thing. Did they ever really think about long-term consequences? Like, okay, we're going to be Pussy Riot for a while, and then we'll do something else. I mean, or is it just they are very focused on the moment when they're doing what they're doing?
I think, again, they took themselves seriously, so they thought they were creating for posterity, but they were also 22 years old, and Pussy Riot lasted from September, in its first incarnation, it lasted from September 2011 until February 2012. That's not a terribly long history for even for a short-lived art group. They were still sort of trying to figure out who they were, and they were having intense arguments about what kinds of things were Pussy Riot and what kinds of things weren't Pussy Riot, and whether they should actually perform or they should only stage serial performances that they would then produce a video clip, etc. So I don't think they were thinking ahead into the coming months, much less years. What ended up happening was that they became world-renowned activists and artists. They came out of jail 2 years after their arrest as seasoned political activists, and they had gone in college students who'd staged a prank. They have incredible name recognition. They have a dire responsibility that I think they feel very strongly. And they seem to be handling it incredibly well. I mean, on the one hand, they have launched a prisoners' rights movement. I'm talking about Nadia and Marina, the two women who ended up serving time. They launched a prisoners' rights movement to try to do sort of some more old-fashioned human rights work in regards to what they saw in prison and what they feel they can communicate to the rest of the world. Unlike other Russian inmates who've experienced similar things, they have that opportunity. And at the same time, they're continuing as Pussy Riot, and they staged the action in Sochi, which again showed how good they are at pointing out exactly what ails Russia. And they, I don't think they meant to get themselves ticked to the ground and whipped by Cossacks, but they certainly meant to have a confrontation with those bizarre, extremely conservative, nationalist, traditionalist Russian forces. And it ended up being a spectacular confrontation, a really frightening one if you look it up on YouTube.
Well, you know, come to think of it, when you think about the history of Russia, the fact that here we are talking in 2014 about being whipped by Cossacks, I mean, this sounds like something out of 1905 from Nicholas II's reign. So, you know, there's this strange sort of echo of things that happened in Russia's past, continuing to happen in Russia's present and possibly in the future as well. I want to take a call here from John in Vineta, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Masha Gessen, the author of Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot.
Good morning, Jeff and Masha.
Hi.
I hope I didn't miss something. I didn't catch all of the program at the beginning here, but what I wanted to ask Masha is, what does the everyday common folks think of Pussy Riot and Snowden and the whole idea of transparent government? I'm always curious about what the folks that carry all this on their back are thinking, because, you know, if they start thinking a different way, things might change. But anyway, I'd like to hear what you have to say. I'll get out of here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. It is a great question. And what does the average Russian think about it? I mean, I'm reminded of Jason Jones. I don't know if you saw his work on The Daily Show recently when he went to Moscow to talk about gay rights. And he was running into some seriously anti-gay rights people, which might have been surprising, I suppose, to the rest of the world, given how things are changing in America. But what do the average people in Russia think of the work of Pussy Riot?
Well, the average people in Russia are television consumers. And television has been controlled by the state for 13 years. A year after coming into office, Putin completed the process of taking over all broadcast television, which beams out to 98% of the households in Russia. So that's half a generation of near total media control, which is to say the average Russian thinks what the Kremlin told him or her to think about Pussy Riot. And what the Kremlin has told him or her to think about Pussy Riot was that they went into church and committed an act of blasphemy. The state has completely obscured the political nature of the protest. This was a very important part of the trial, was to prevent witnesses or the defendants from talking about the political nature of the protest, from even saying Putin's name. It focused on the blasphemy. So, yeah, the average Russian perceived them as true hooligans, which is the crime that they were tried for.
Given their propensity for protest, when Nadezhda and Maria were on trial, were they comporting themselves with the judges? I honestly know what the courtroom said it was, but were they following courtroom protocol, or were they being more like Pussy Riot members?
Well, actually, there was a bizarre bit of role reversal that happened during the trial. On the one hand, the prosecution and the judge were singing the same tune. It was very clear that they were working together. And the prosecutor wasn't very good, so the judge kept taking over and doing the prosecution's cross-examination for it. So that was happening on the one hand. The defense lawyers were basically three clowns who were completely out of their depth and kept trying to sort of act out and turn it into what they understood to be a public trial, which was a little bit like a punk performance. One of my favorite absurd moments in the trial is when they come into the courtroom late and the judge says, "I reprimand one of the defense lawyers," and another defense lawyer says, "I want to reprimand two." And the judge says, "For the record, reprimands for the entire defense team." So it was kind of shenanigans that didn't seem like anybody was taking the trial seriously. Meanwhile, Nadia, Maria, and Kat were seeing their lives change before their eyes. They were seeing horrible lies told about them. It was very painful for them to listen to the prosecution say that what they had done was motivated by hatred for Russian Orthodox believers. That was how their crime was supposedly motivated. And they don't have a hateful bone in their bodies. And they ended up writing very straightforward, very sort of rhetorically rigorous closing statements which they read on the last day of the trial. The closing statements are all very different, but they're all very political and very clear. And I included them in the book in their entirety because I think they provide sort of the best explanation for who these women are and what really motivated their protest.
The widespread belief is that Vladimir Putin let Nadezhda and Maria out of prison because he wanted to make a good show for the world just before the Winter Olympics got started in Sochi. And yet, as the Olympics were still going on, they ended up in Sochi protesting against Putin's regime. Do you think that that was, he had no idea that that was going to happen? Do you think he thought they'd be good people? Or good people in his mind, I guess, is the point.
I think he underestimated them in an extremely sexist way. I think basically what he thought was that he'd given them a good spanking, and now the girls were going to sit quietly. And it's interesting, you know, he released a number of high-profile political prisoners in advance of the Sochi Olympics, just as he was putting lower-profile political prisoners into prison, right? So this was very much a cosmetic operation before the Games. But he made sure that somebody like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former oil tycoon who had served 10 years in prison, was under control, was forced into political exile, and was going to keep quiet. He made sure that the Greenpeace activists went back to their respective countries. But he didn't take care of Pussy Riot because I think he felt he had nothing to fear, and they've proven him wrong.
I guess we will see in the days ahead what happens. This is a story that obviously is clearly still being written, but it's a good effort in this book. Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha Gessen, thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about the Ashland Watershed Project, get an update on that. We'll talk about breast cancer treatment developments, and we'll talk to women in positions of leadership about what it takes to get there and stay there. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. Thank you.